Du lytter til Radio 24/7.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor der den her uge er en defekt telefon og en hund, der ikke er helt almindelig. Hunden, den tilhører Maja Smreka fra Slovakiet. Hun er kunstner og vokset op i et hjem med hundekennel, og hun udfordrer i den grad, hvad man kan med genetik, og hvad man må, og hvad man ikke må, og hvad man måske kan med kunstig intelligens, som hun i øvrigt mener bør være mere som hunde. Men først så skal vi tale sikkerhed, selvkørende biler og sygehuse. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf. Velkommen til.
Two answers before you even get started. I don't know, and if I did, we wouldn't talk about it anyway.
Most of these systems are relatively easy for a sophisticated hacker to get into.
So you're typing on the phone that will run out of software updates in a very short while.
Yeah.
Could I start to get you to introduce yourself so I can get a kind of a level on you?
Sure. I'm Ross Anderson. I'm Professor of Security Engineering at the University of Cambridge.
Just a minute ago, you were holding your phone in your hand. That's a Nexus 5X or something like that. You're having some trouble with that phone.
Well, I got myself a Nexus because the Google own brand phones tend to get software upgrades for longer than other phones. And if you don't get regular software upgrades, then your phone is vulnerable to being hacked. So having bought this phone in September 2016... I now find that Google is going to stop offering software upgrades in September of this year. And I think that's pretty bad stuff. It's less than 3 years service life for something that cost me, gosh, about £600.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's the same thing here. But, also, I think actually, is iOS a bit better on that, or is that the same thing?
I think iOS is a bit better, but Apple's been in trouble recently for deliberately slowing down the CPUs in older phones once the battery starts to become exhausted. And, of course, Apple makes a lot of money by charging you for a replacement battery. So there are many exploitative commercial practices here. And so many of our electronic goods are really just, you know, transient goods rather than being properly durable goods.
Ross Anderson er professor i sikkerhed ved Cambridge University, og han har et problem med sin telefon. Det er en ældre Google Nexus, og telefonen er sådan set god nok, men den modtager ikke længere opdateringer, fordi Google gerne vil have, man køber en ny. Men en ting er telefoner, der går bricked, som man siger, når noget ikke længere kan opdateres og holde op med at virke. Noget helt andet er alt det udstyr, der står i vores hospitaler, og som kan betyde liv og død for patienten. Og så er der de selvkørende biler og Internet of Things, alle mulige dem, som er indbygget internet, som heller ikke kommer til at få de opdateringer, der er nødvendige. Det eneste, der kan redde os i den sammenhæng, det er krav fra regeringer og standarder, regler for opdateringer, mener Ross Anderson. Men kan forbrugerne selv gøre noget?
Consumers are almost powerless in this space, because firstly, if you're dealing with IT companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft, they're mostly monopolies, and they're vastly more powerful than any individual consumer. And if you're dealing with car companies, you know, you typically have two or three big car companies in every country. You know, you have got Peugeot and Citroën in France, you have got Volkswagen, Audi Group and Mercedes and BMW in Germany, and so on and so forth. And these are, in effect, cartels. Now, like it or not, the regulation of these monopolies and cartels is done by the European Union, right? Because Washington doesn't care and nobody else is big enough to matter. So when it comes to privacy, it's Europe with its general data protection regulation which makes all the running, and companies engineer their products to be acceptable in Europe, and that has beneficial side effects for people in Peru or Malaysia or wherever. Now, we believe that the same thing will happen with safety, and that the safety of self-driving cars and of smart medical devices and so on will be a matter for European regulation. And the opinions of ministers in Denmark or in Britain or whatever will not be relevant, except insofar as, you know, Denmark has a voice in the Council of Europe.
Look, it sounds nice. We hope they're listening more to that, because as you went through in your presentation, security and safety is becoming a very big issue currently, and you were especially mentioning cars, self-driving cars in the future. Could you give a few examples of why we should look into what is happening to self-driving cars currently?
There's an awful lot being talked about self-driving cars and vans and trucks, and we already see some trains, for example, that on the Docklands Light Railway in London, there are no drivers in the trains. In effect, the trains are remotely piloted, you know, just like the drones over Afghanistan. You've got a guy sitting in the signal box with 10 VDUs in front of him, and he's driving all the trains on the line. Similarly, when you get self-driving cars, there'll be something similar to that. There will be somebody sitting in a control room who can take over the cars remotely if need be. But when you think carefully about, for example, self-driving delivery vans, that's going to be a very different thing. Because at present, if you are a delivery van driver in a congested and busy city like Cambridge or London or perhaps Copenhagen or Aarhus, then much of your job is making a judgment call about whether you can double park for 40 seconds in order to dash into a house and deliver a parcel. And robots are very bad at doing that. They're very bad at making judgment calls on when they can break the law. They're also very bad at running upstairs with a parcel and deciding to leave it behind the flower pot when the old lady doesn't answer the door. So I think people who say that there will be millions of people made unemployed as a result of self-driving vans are being scaremongering. What may happen is that once vans have an autopilot that will work on the motorway, the companies will then use this to cut drivers' wages or extend their working hours, and that then becomes a labour issue.
But you're saying that it will actually become... we might look into a future where it becomes less effective and more... We'll have more congestion in many ways, because we have the self-driving cars have a lot of problems making decisions about breaking the law.
Well, there's not just that. I mean, the vision in Silicon Valley, where they're developing, you know, stuff like Waymo and Tesla and so on, is that people are constrained by their commute. You know, you might have to drive for an hour or so to get to work in Google because the congestion in the morning is bad. So what people do now is they will get on a Google bus, and, you know, even if that leaves San Francisco at 6 in the morning, they can sit down for 2 hours as it inches its way along the motorway. They can open their laptop, they can write some software, they can drink some cappuccino, they can eat a croissant. And so it's actually a civilized way to commute in a Google bus. Now, could you do that with cars? That's the vision. Could you live in somewhere cheap like Mendocino and just drive into Mountain View every morning with your car doing the driving? So you sit in the back of your car and you write software while the car takes you to work. Now, the problem is that if everybody does that, the congestion becomes way worse. Way, way worse.
And I keep thinking that in many ways, all the good things about self-driving cars and all that we seem to long for is actually just they're just trains in many ways, and will end up, as you said, with somebody sitting remotely and controlling them.
I suspect that with many cars, there will be a halfway house where there's something like an autopilot that works on the motorway. And there will also be routines that will help you move slowly in congested traffic. But the problem is there's always going to be difficult times where human judgment is required, and these may come on you quite quickly. And so if you're not paying attention, if you've got your laptop open and you're writing software or watching a movie, you know, and suddenly something happens, then it's going to take you several seconds to understand what's going on. That's going to be a source of hazards.
Det eneste regulerer noget som helst i forhold til sikkerhed, det er EU. USA er ligeglade, siger Ross Anderson, der tænker meget over, hvordan fremtiden kan komme til at se ud, hvis vi for eksempel får seriøse mængder af de her selvkørende biler. For dem er der store problemer med. Ikke med softwaren, men med den måde, de virker på. Man kan allerede nu se automatisk kørsel i vores tog for eksempel. De har ikke nogen fører, men styres på afstand. Det kan vi forstå. Men hvad med for eksempel en bil, der bringer varer ud automatisk og uden fører? Hvordan skal den kunne finde ud af, hvor den må parkere, om den må dobbeltparkere her og hvor længe? Det er noget, som robotter er vildt dårlige til, og det vil medføre kaos. Ross Anderson mener generelt, at selvkørende biler er noget værre rod, medmindre man altså holder dem på motorvejsstrækninger, hvor de ikke skal tænke sig om. Men tilbage til det med hospitalerne og sikkerheden. Og det ser slemt ud, mener Ross Anderson.
We're beginning to find security issues with devices in hospitals. Back in 2015, the Hospira Symbic infusion pump was recalled in America because it turned out to be trivial to attack it over Wi-Fi. If you were within radio range of it, you could take the pump over, you could increase the dose, you could decrease the dose, and you could use that as a means of getting into the hospital network. And the reason that these vulnerabilities arise is that everybody thought security was somebody else's business. The people running hospital networks assumed that devices like infusion pumps would be secure, while the makers of infusion pumps assumed that they would be connected to secure networks. So security was always somebody else's problem. And this is what you get in a normal competitive environment, unless there's a regulator which lays down the law about whose responsibility is what.
But we're living in a time where nobody likes the regulators.
Well, a consequence of not having these markets properly regulated is that medical devices kill about as many people as cars do. In Britain, it's reckoned that something like 2,000 people a year die as a result of safety usability failures in medical devices. And there is no real incentive to fix this, because the people who die, die one at a time. They're usually very old or very young, or they've been very badly injured in a car crash. They might have died anyway. And at a hospital like Addenbrooke's in Cambridge, you know, where my lab is, that might translate to 10 people dying a year in such accidents. Now, 10 a year in a hospital the size of Cambridge's hospital, you know, must be about number 15 or number 20 on the list of causes of death. So it's not something that the management of the hospital will worry about very much. The medical device regulator doesn't worry about it very much because the regulator is captured. You know, the regulator does the bidding of the medical device makers and provides them with basically legislative cover. So it's nobody's job to fix medical safety. Right? The doctors blame the nurses when something goes wrong. The nurses have no public voice. The way in which medical devices are marketed is often predatory. They will give you the device for free, provided you use their tubes, which costs a lot of money. And so the whole thing is somewhere where to get a decent result, you need strong regulation.
Yeah. And one of the problems you also mentioned in your talk is also there's a design problem, which is actually very obvious, meaning that a certain piece of equipment that actually does the same may look dramatically different in one version to the other.
A big problem is indeed that different devices, even different devices from the same maker, have got very different interfaces. It's as if some cars had the accelerator on the right, the brake on the left, and the clutch on the far left, but other cars had the accelerator between the brake and the clutch, which was what happened in the 1930s with some cars. Now, in the case of medical devices, each device maker will say, well, my products are okay, it's up to the other manufacturers to make their products like mine. And none will budge. So here again, there's a number of things you could do. Now, the obvious thing to do would be for the hospital to insist that no nurse use a syringe pump unless she had received current training on that device. This is what happens with aircraft, right? You're not allowed, if you're a Boeing 737 pilot, to just sit in an Airbus 321 and fly it. You have to go and do a course. You have to do an exam. You have to do a simulator ride with an instructor. You have to do regular training. And so there is a cost involved in transferring a pilot from Airbus to Boeing. And for this reason, Boeing decided to make all its cockpits the same. Starting with the 757 and the 767, they saw to it that the layout is exactly identical, so if you qualify on a 767, you're also legal to fly a 757. Now, if you had these rules about staff training and qualification in hospitals, then hospitals would decide to buy all of their syringe pumps from the same maker or from makers who provided the same user interface.
And that will increase safety in many ways.
That would significantly increase safety. But the problem for a typical hospital is that people who die as a result of medical accidents might be about the 15th or 20th biggest cause of death from people in the hospital. So the hospital's medical director is more worried about things like MRSA infection. He's more worried about things like bed capacity in winter when there's an influenza epidemic. He's got a dozen more important things to worry about than medical device safety. And he will perhaps hope that the government will fix that for him by means of better regulation. This is how things break in practice.
Sikkerhed på hospitalerne har altid været andre folks problem, selvom fejl i medicinsk elektronik faktisk slår 2.000 mennesker ihjel om året i England. Det er flere, end der dør i biluheld. Som flere og flere tingene får indbygget internet, så bliver de også mulige mål for hacker, der bruger dem til at få adgang til hele hospitalets systemer. Det kræver endnu en gang regulering fra regeringer, mener Ross Anderson. Og så er der problemerne igen med opdateringerne af software, noget som NHS, de engelske offentlige hospitaler, opdagede for et par år siden, hvor de blev angrebet af ransomware, fordi hospitalerne ikke var opdateret på deres Windows. Det medførte kaos på hospitalerne og læger, der gik rundt med papir og blyant for at få styr på aftaler. Men det var faktisk ikke kun opdateringernes skyld, mener Ross Anderson.
Well, the NHS case was a complicated one because it turned out later that the Windows machines that were infected were all Windows Vista machines where people had turned off automatic updating. And they blamed Windows XP because that was the first excuse that came to mind, but it turned out that almost no Windows XP machines were actually infected. Now, in order to get the WannaCry virus, two things had to happen. First, you had to have turned off updating on your Windows Vista, which one or two people did in order to cope with legacy software. And the second thing you had to do was to open the port on your firewall to allow Windows file sharing. Now, this was because of the complexity of how things are run in the NHS and typically how they are mismanaged. If you were a private individual and you're using Windows Vista out of the box and you were using a standard commercial ISP, then you were not at risk. So it's down to managing complexity.
Yeah. We went into the problem. The main thing was that Microsoft went out and said, you should just have gotten rid of this and have done this updates immediately to our software. And then the NHS said, well, we have a lot of software which we've made ourselves and it's not running on Windows 10. And that's kind of a problem. But what should we do about this in the future? Because that's not the only place this is going to happen.
Well, the most of the places where they had Windows XP in NHS systems were in embedded equipment. You know, things like body scanners, things like scintillation counters in the hematology department and so on. And if the maker of your body scanner won't upgrade the embedded operating system on which it runs, what do? You go and spend €5 million on buying a new scanner. Do you sue him? This is a real problem. A practical approach might be to put this device behind a very, very pernickety firewall so that bad stuff can't get at it. But, you know, there are even older things knocking about out there. I mean, I hear of Windows 95 machines being used in nuclear power stations, for example, because that's what it was designed to use and the cost of certifying a different system would be too great.
We're currently in the middle of this, especially in Europe, very rapid digitalization. Things are moving fast. And especially everybody's currently saying IoT all over the place. What are the big stress? You had this word you were talking about, sustainable computing. How are we going to maintain that?
Well, for computing to be sustainable, we have to think in terms of how do you maintain software for an extended lifetime, for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. For things like cars, perhaps for 40 years for power stations. Now, one option is that you just tear out the computers every 5 years and you replace them. And I was speaking to an engineer from Vestas yesterday, one of the big engineering companies here in Denmark, and he says that their servers are simply scheduled for replacement in their products every 5 years. That's one possible strategy, but you have to have a strategy. Now, if you've got a car with 50 different CPUs in it, which have come from different component suppliers, then simply replacing all the car's electronics every 5 years isn't an option, right? So what are you going to do? That's a hard one.
And we're looking into the future, but everybody's saying that one of the examples you mentioned is that if you need to change stuff on cars, everyone was talking about one of the solutions for cars is to kind of give them a shorter lifespan so they get out of and then. But you don't think that's not going to happen?
I've heard engineers at one big car company say that in future, when cars go self-driving, they will last for only 6 years, and then they will be replaced. The problem with this is that if you go and buy a luxury car nowadays, the embedded carbon cost might be 30 or 35 tons. That's the amount of CO2 that was emitted to smelt the steel, to make the plastics, to tan the leather, and so on and so forth. And that's a little bit more than all the CO2 that will be emitted in its lifetime from burning fuel, right? So most of the cost of owning a car is actually the cost of making the car. Now, if you reduce the lifetime of a car from 300,000 kilometers to 100,000 kilometers, that means you triple the emissions from embedded carbon. And this would mean that overall, you would almost double the total CO2 emissions from road transport. Now, if we're trying to meet the Paris climate change targets, that's not going to work. So simply reducing car lifetime isn't an option. You have to make the software last longer.
Det var altså Ross Anderson, professor i sikkerhed ved Cambridge University, der her til sidst talte om, hvordan man kunne lave bæredygtig IT ved at lade softwaren køre i længere tid med flere opdateringer.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Og nu bliver vi lidt i det medicinske. Det bliver mildt sagt lidt mere syret. Vi skal nemlig møde kunstneren Maja Svemkar fra Slovakiet og hendes islandske hund Ada. Jeg mødte Maja til Klikfestivalen til en samtale om kunst og videnskab, om hvordan man kloner sig selv med sin hund.
Island hund is called Ada, and I also have another one who stayed in Slovenia in this beautiful dog hotel, which I actually call a dog spa. He has a lot of friends there and really good program through the day. So his name is Byron. They both are actually called by the real persons. Byron is called by Lord George Gordon Byron, the poet, and Ada is named by his daughter, one of the first programmers, Lady Ada Lovelace. So they are actually kind of my, let's say, paraphrase of the art and science. Yeah.
She was. She actually added. There's actually software now called Ada, which is. It's in. It's in fighter planes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But it's been designed.
So. I need to check it out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Super questions.
Yeah.
Ada, maybe she could say something. Please. Ada, hey.
How would you describe a personality?
She's quite intelligent in the way that she knows how to take care of herself. She is very. She's a team player, I think she. I can feel that she has quite deep emotional intelligence, but she's also very promiscuous. I call her little putana. She's very promiscuous with other dogs. She needs to make friends with everybody without a filter. I don't think that's healthy.
Probably not. Especially not among dogs.
No. No.
Yeah. Really cute and very nice.
Yeah, she's really nice. I mean, I know that it sounds like I'm super subjective and mystifying my dog, but I think it's also the breed. The Icelandic dogs are really very old breed and known very much to be as much team players as they are able to decide for themselves when necessary. And this is usually, these are usually virtues of the old breeds. While my other dog, who is a border collie, Scottish border collie, that is, he is only learning by heart. He cannot make a decision by himself, and he's always waiting for somebody to tell him what to do. This is when he's happy. But it's a new breed. I mean, relatively, like,
And you grew up with the dogs, with dog breeding when you were a child?
Yes.
In a family where there were breeding dogs, and so you had them all around you all the time?
Yes, yes. They were, like, when I was little, I would be percepting them as my brothers and sisters. So, it's been always, in dog company, it's been always a feeling of home to me. Yeah. I like to collaborate with dogs because they have they possess quite a deep emotional intelligence, which has been actually seen throughout our whole parallel evolution. And I think that they might actually, if we would be interested as humans, they might remind us of what it means to be a human animal. And I feel like there is some kind of quality which has been quite suppressed in the contemporary times, since we are living a lot in this relationship which is very much intertwined with different kinds of computation and artificial intelligence. So the dog is some kind of a matrix with which I try to amaze, through which I try to actually find some kind of level of actually freedom. Yes.
To free the dogs, or to free the last thing you said was to
free myself.
To free yourself.
Oh yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Could you describe some? The problem with the radio is that it's very hard to we can't show pictures. But could you describe some of the works in which your dog has been participating?
Yes. I've been. I executed a few projects where dogs have been my collaborators until now. In 2014, I executed an installation which was paraphrasing the parallel evolution between humans and dogs, as it turned out that dog has been when dog slowly stopped being a wolf. That was, let's say, approximately at the beginning of the agricultural revolution. At that time, that half wolf, half dog, decided to stay, not to be the nomad, like a human also decided that, and to stay at one place, cultivate food, and have a shelter, villages. That diet was a very, very important parameter in this parallel evolution, since they both then were actually their selection pressure for their physiological evolvement was the diet of starch and meat mainly, which nowadays we know is not very healthy, right? but it was going on for quite a while. Also, on the other hand, those dogs, these early dogs, were still actually having the social dynamics of the wolf, which meant that they would actually be taking the role of the guard, which means that they became bio indicators for humans, so humans could be relaxed and they would actually only be stressed when the dog would actually tell them when it's time to be alarmed. So these two parameters have been one of the crucial parameters in humans for some human genes to mutate, and one of these genes has been the one that is called very technically SLC6A4, but it has to do with the regulation of serotonin transporter, and serotonin is actually the hormone which helps us be nice to each other, actually. So it's not a hormone of happiness, it's actually a hormone of tolerance. And therefore, I say in that first project that I was collaborating with dogs that actually our culture actually started because of dogs. So in that project, I made a huge installation, a huge cave-like installation where the participant, human participant, the guest would come into really deep, and then it would have to crawl down, and there it would be the a drop of a hot plate, a drop of serotonin, which was isolated out of blood from me and my dog companion. And it was then biotechnologically transformed into an odor. So a human would not, so while the human would come to the place of the installation where there was this serotonin to be smelled, the vision, it would be total darkness, and there would be the sense of smell which would actually come to front, which is actually the primal still sense in dogs, while in humans it is the visual cortex.
So you're kind of switching the positions there between
yes.
dogs and humans.
Yes, while telling the story of parallel evolution. Yes.
Maja kan lide at samarbejde med hunden. De har dyb følelsesmæssig intelligens, siger hun, og hvis vi ellers gad at høre efter dem, så kan de godt minde os om, hvad det vil sige at være et menneskedyr. Hunden er en slags matrix, som jeg prøver at befri mig selv igennem, siger hun. Hendes hunde har deltaget i flere projekter, blandt andet en installation, der viser, hvornår hunde holdt op med at være ulve ved at vise ændringer i deres kost, der bragte dem tættere på mennesker, selvom de stadig havde ulvens opførsel, hvorved de blev vagter for os mennesker, hvilket igen gjorde, at vi mennesker, vi kunne slappe af. Og det fik faktisk vi menneskers gener til at mutere, så vi kunne transportere mere serotonin. Det er et hormon for lykke, eller som hun siger, tolerance, så derfor så startede vores rigtige kultur med hunde, siger altså Maja, der lavede en hule, hvor der dryppede blod med serotonin fra Maja og hendes hund. Blodet, der kunne lugtes, og som burde medføre mere tolerance hos publikum. Men hvorfor så videnskabeligt?
You have a very scientific way of going into a lot of your art. Do you have a scientific background?
No. No, but the field of art where I am active is actually connecting artistic and, so to say, maybe in the broader sense, humanistic and natural sciences. Mm-hmm. Humanistic and natural sciences. So I am collaborating with scientists quite a lot. I also do a lot of my research, but still, I never predict any... at the beginning of my research, I never predict any results because I am not a scientist and what I do are not scientific projects. Science, different scientific tools, in my case, are just artistic mediums. And I think since science is so omnipotent in this zeitgeist, in the contemporary world, I decided to actually employ scientific tools as mediums of my art, because I think it comes through much better the communication with the broader public if I use the tools that are contemporary, if those tools are the ones which are actually surrounding us on the everyday basis almost, mm-hmm. even though they are sometimes invisible.
I was wondering, you have I think it's been called a controversial project, actually, in within part of an art project, having a non-reproductive self from your own dog implanted in yourself.
But the ovum was outside okay. of my body.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Which means in vitro. Yes. So, yeah, in that project, that was the... fourth project in the artistic, the series of artistic projects called Canine Topology. This project, actually, in this project, all this parallel evolution and paradigm and connected with my emotional memory from. My childhood, since I've been growing up in the family where they were breeding dogs, I was an only child, I had a very special connection with them while growing up. So all this culminated in this actually ecofeministic concept, which was trying to communicate that we should start living in much more responsible manner, considering our taking care of our planet. So that is why in my late 30s I decided consciously that instead of having children, I am going to have my reproductive cell extracted from my body into the petri dish, then and then there was the core of that cell was taken out, and then the non-reproductive cell of my dog, the one that is here now, isolated out of her saliva, so no animals were hurt here. Except maybe human ones, consciously. we put the non-reproductive cell into the reproductive, but just into the the empty cell.
Yeah.
What could happen here? Nothing could happen here, but this biotechnological procedure is usually used in cloning. Of course, we didn't do that, and also since it was different, such different two species, nothing would happen. However, we then, after 3 days, stored this hybrid cell into the cryosleep, which is minus 198 degrees Celsius. So it was, I called it, again in this project, I was absolutely using the biotechnology as an artistic medium. And what I said I did here in artistic terms was molecular sculpture. On the as a political statement, what I was stating was that I want to be the one to be the owner of my own body, and I'm going to do with my reproductive material whatever I want, not that what the society tells me to do with it. But on the other hand, I also wanted to stress that there is that this planet is actually absolutely too populated, and that we should also be considering that big time.
What were the reactions? I would expect some angry people, maybe some religious beliefs or stuff that you kind of that people got upset about.
Well, I got a very big prize. Artistic prize, so that was one of the reactions. The I didn't get a very bad reactions from the so to say the representatives of the religious institutions. However, I got quite some negative reactions from the populists all over the world, but I think that is just actually that just made the point that I had even more.
Jeg prøver at få hård videnskab til at gå op med humanisme, siger Maja Schremkar. Jeg går aldrig efter resultaterne, for jeg er jo ikke videnskabsmand. Jeg bruger det kun som et medie, siger hun. Et af de mere kontroversielle projekter, hun står bag, var, da hun valgte at klone et af sine egne æg med en ikke-reproduktiv celle fra sin hund og sætte det hele i en kunstig livmor, hvor cellen så gik i gang med at udvikle sig i nogle dage. Det kan genlyde verden over. Hun brugte samme teknik, som man i dag bruger ved kloning. Efter 3 dage så blev cellen taget ud af livmoren og frosset ned som en slags molekylær skulptur. Jeg vil gøre ved min krop, hvad der passer mig, siger Maja Schremkar, der fik en pris for værket og også mange negative reaktioner for, hvad hun kalder populister over hele verden. Men hvad kan hun gøre for kunstig intelligens, og hvordan ser hun sig selv i kunstig intelligens-termer?
You're going to talk about artificial intelligence later and what artificial, how dogs can contribute to artificial intelligence. If we go back, I was thinking about, maybe it's a stupid game, but I was wondering, would it be possible if you should describe yourself in terms of artificial intelligence?
Well, super, very good question. Although I'm not sure how I'm going to answer it, but I like it. To describe myself in terms of artificial intelligence. Well, it's not that hard, actually. I think I'm acting a lot like artificial intelligence, since artificial intelligence usually is acting, is actually learning through some different kind of behavioristic methods, which are actually quite old, right? B.F. Skinner, etc. But this is how it's done. Reinforced behavior is actually being applied quite a lot to the machine learning, which is being which has been applied quite a lot to our society. And therefore, I think I don't actually that I'm not so totally different from as is none of us that is using technology on a daily basis. None of us is so much actually different from artificial intelligence. What I actually am trying to discover in my new project, which I'm going to present today as a talk only because I'm just starting, is whether things would be any different if this, maybe this tyranny, so-called tyranny of techne, would be any different if a dog was computing, that is coding artificial intelligence, the algorithm. Mm. So, because there, then the next logical question would be, but could I describe a dog in terms of artificial intelligence? I totally could, because this behavioristic methods have also been applied really a lot in the dog training. But for the last some 10 years, dog training methods have radically changed into the actually what I could call maybe post-humanist kind of angle, where dogs' agency is very much actually taken into consideration when one would want to communicate whichever actually relationship with the dog, and that is the imperative at the moment, which to me it kind of seems like we are translating our deep desires, you know, we are in this total techno-neurosis, but then we are translating our deep desires to actually to regain actually our human animality again through this training of dogs, which is actually starting to be much, much more empathical. So that's to me really an interesting paradigm.
How do you, if you look at you as artificial intelligence, how do you train your algorithms?
I try to repeat. So the society is training me in terms of more or less uniformed individual, which goes in line with all the other individuals, while I constantly try to hack that and train myself by repeating the opposite actions, so to train myself into the more, hopefully, wishful thinking, emancipatory position. Mm. Yeah.
Do we have a...
So it's all training from all sides, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Everybody's training everybody.
Exactly.
Everything is training everything. Yeah. Do we
it's
have
a very... not reductionistic, but how is it called? It's very deterministic, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying in this new project to create an ontological window of knowledge which I could open and then maybe go to some, I don't know, like a parallel path, which would hopefully tell us some, show us some alternative to this determinism.
Mm. Ville et teknologisk tyranni måske være anderledes og venligere, hvis algoritmerne blev programmeret af hunde? En hund er nemlig nem at beskrive i AI-termer. De minder rigtig meget om, hvordan man træner algoritmer. Der er kommet en slags postmenneskelig vinkel ind over, hvor man tager hundes følelser med i købet og ser hundetræning som en måde at genvinde sin følelse af at være et dyr, et menneskedyr. Men har hun et mål, hvor alt smelter sammen til sådan en stor enhed, en AI-singularitet? Jo da, siger hun. Hund, menneske og maskine i en stor enhed.
Dog, human, machine. This should be, I think, the singularity which would which should actually teach each other how to act in a non-brute force.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we need dogs inside this loop.
This is my frame of thought, and I think since dogs are actually turned out to be our very successful domesticated nature, the representatives of this super successful product of evolution, I think, yes, we should be giving dogs a little bit more credit on how to survive in culture, human culture. Yeah.
There's one of actually a very interesting thing, because within artificial intelligence, they have this concept of instant learning, which they are having problems with, because with the example of instant learning is that if you show a child a dog or a cat, then a child only needs to see one dog. And then whenever it sees a dog afterwards, it will keep saying, this is a dog, this is a dog, this is a dog. If you have to learn a system, a computer system, the same thing, you'll need to show it maybe 20,000 dogs, and it will still probably get it wrong. And they're using dogs as the example of a place where humans have instant learning, and where we can kind of move on to that. There's a lot of discussion about how far we're actually coming within artificial intelligence. Do you think will we see artificial intelligence having kind of the same kind of instant learning in the future as we have as humans?
That might happen, maybe, but definitely not in the way of this brute force approach, which is actually, as you said, an algorithm needs to see 100 million dogs in order to know what a dog is. So I think that the new approaches, which are already kind of conceptually starting to happen, are more training and less data. And that is why I'm actually also seeing some kind of interesting position, emancipatory position between all three entities through training. And obviously humans already started to actually achieve the paradigmatic shift in animal training, not just dog training, actually all animal training. And through this kind of training, maybe we could learn something, what it means, the non-brute force, and somehow translate it into the technological field, I mean, the field of machine learning. Yes. I'm not sure how, and I know it's very far-fetched, but I intuitively feel there is something there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're going to work on it continuously.
Yes, I'm starting actually working on it with my collaborators, human and non-human. Non-human, then dividing to living non-human and non-living non-human. We are all collaborating in my new project. I think it's very important to be precise in classification. I'm also going to be presenting this now at my talk today. We are for now composing a simulation code for a simulation based on the behavior of dogs, how they solve a maze. That simulation is going to show us how to compose a concept for the real code, which is going to be the neural network learning code. And then we're going to actually move all together the real parkour with the totally written algorithm for learning. Of course, with the canine experts, we're trying to analyze what the dog is training us about, and then we are translating that. We are talking to the programmers, and we are translating that into the code for the simulation.
You're kind of actually taking yourself out of the loop in a way, saying if we get into a kind of future where the dog may only need an artificial intelligence to kind of keep it amused.
No, what I want to say with this is that maybe we should, humans should stop a bit, observe and think a lot.
Det var altså Maja Srimkar fra Slovakiet og hendes hund Ada, som jeg havde mødt på Klikfestivalen i Helsingør. Med det så er aflyttet forbi for i dag. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærhul, for jeg vender tilbage i næste uge med mere nyt fra det overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bor og gør i. Hvor siger vi? Hvor, mens vi lukker øjnene og drømmer om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7.